This week on Making Contact.
The truth of the American war against Korea was never told, never fully told to the American people.
When George Bush named North Korea in his axis of evil, it brought the country into the headlines. But an American role in Korea is nothing new. Correspondents Nok Wen and Aaron Glantz were in Korea during the 50th anniversary of the armistice that ended the Korean War. They take an in-depth look into the history of the U.S. involvement in Korea from the Second World War to present. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
Anchi Wan sings in front of a crowd of students in a small fishing village that's also home to a U.S. bombing range. Korea's most popular political pop musician screaming the words of a poem about the border that separates North and South Korea. In front of the wire netting, he sings, Korea divided. The river flows through that wire. The river flows with a fresh dream. We were divided even though we were so close. That wire netting was standing in the way, the rusty wire netting. Let's lay down our guns. Let's take off the rusty wire netting. Let's flow wherever we want. Most Koreans, young and old, yearn for reunification. But on whose terms and under whose leadership? Today, many South Korean activists don't feel threatened by North Korea.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil.
In his 2002 State of the Union speech, George W. Bush singled out North Korea as one of three evil countries in the world. Shortly thereafter, the country pulled out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and announced it would start investigating how to build a nuclear bomb.
By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
George Katsiafikas, president of the Peace Island Foundation, says George Bush could easily end the nuclear standoff.
In exchange for a promise, a non-aggression pact from the United States, they will give up their nuclear weapons program entirely and stop the export of rockets and missiles. They have said this repeatedly, and yet the United States won't even discuss the proposal.
The biggest worry among many Koreans is that America might preemptively attack North Korea, starting a war on the peninsula, a scenario almost everyone here opposes. The devastation from the Korean War is still strong in the minds of many people. In 1950, communist North Korea invaded South Korea and nearly took the entire peninsula. America fought back on the side of South Korea, driving the North Koreans almost all the way back to the Chinese border. At which point, China entered the war and pushed the American army back to the original border between North and South Korea. The two Koreas never signed a peace treaty. There was only an armistice agreement, a ceasefire, between the United States, North Korea, and China. 50 years later, 37,000 U.S. troops are still stationed in South Korea, and the North and South remain formally at war. In their capital, Pyongyang, North Koreans celebrated the 50th anniversary of the armistice with music and fireworks, while hundreds of thousands of North Koreans danced in the street in a giant celebration of victory over the Americans. Professor George Katsiafikas traveled to Pyongyang as part of an international delegation to attend a war crimes tribunal. During his first trip to North Korea, he says he was struck by how united the North Koreans are against the United States.
Everyone there is ready to fight the United States. If the United States attacks, they have absolutely no interest in attacking the United States. But from their perspective and from their daily life, from their television, newspapers, the war never ended. So for more than half a century, they've been fighting the United States. And this recent threat by George Bush of preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea is very real to them.
Yoo Mi-jung is with the Korean Truth Commission. The group was established 3 years ago to investigate alleged war crimes committed by the U.S. military during the Korean War. Jung says the commission has been collecting stories of people who witnessed war crimes. Those stories were buried for decades due to repression by military dictatorships in South Korea, but she says the political climate is changing.
Because of AP reporting in 1999, September, of Nogunri massacre, where several hundreds of South Koreans were pinned under the bridge in Nogunri and strapped and machine gunned and died. And because of a change of political climate in South Korea, that sort of unleashed these people's experience, people's desire to speak about what has happened to them 50 years ago by U.S. military.
Katsi Fiska says after Nogunri, many people came forward to tell their stories. He describes the testimony he heard at the tribunal in Pyongyang.
The truth of the American war against Korea was never told, never fully told to the American people. When we were there, we went to a place called Sinchon, a horrific massacre site where American troops raped, brutalized, and murdered for days, for about 40 days. The museum reminded me, in a small way, in terms of the scale of the museum, of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. The shoes of the murdered, the eyeglasses of the murdered, the hair of the murdered. You know, many people were simply tied in bundles and thrown into the river off of a bridge. People were buried alive. Women had their breasts cut off. Perhaps most horrible of all, is that hundreds of children separated from their mothers, held for days without food or water, had gasoline thrown into the room where they were and burnt to crisps. I was in that room. We were in that room. And a horrific feeling of a place where hundreds of children were killed by U.S. troops.
The commission has sent a letter to Washington asking the U.S. government to apologize for the war crimes and offer compensation to the victims and their families. Jung says so far, the U.S. government has not responded.
At the same time in South Korea, hundreds of American veterans of the Korean War flew to Seoul to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the armistice. Speaking at the commemoration, U.S. General Leon Laporte, commander of the 37,000 U.S. troops still in Korea, described the day's events as a grand celebration of what he called the fight against communist aggression. Almost 3 million people died in the war. 1.3 million South Koreans, 1 million Chinese, 500,000 North Koreans, and more than 30,000 American soldiers.
To some, the armistice represents an anticlimactic finish to a complex conflict that flirted with cataclysmic proportions. But to those who fought and bled for freedom, in the snow, in the heat, in the mountainous terrain and in the treacherous valleys of Korea, its purpose is much, much clearer.
For many villagers on South Korea's west coast, though, the armistice marked the beginning, not the end, of a U.S. military bombing campaign. It's 6 p.m. in the small fishing village of Mae-ha-ni, and a U.S. Air Force Apache helicopter flies along the boardwalk. It's almost never quiet here. The sky is full of F-15, F-16, and A-10 fighter jets. The Air Force has brought them from all over the Pacific to this South Korean village. For American soldiers stationed in Okinawa, Japan, Thailand, and Guam, this is the place to practice. American fighter jets take to the skies up to 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, to bomb a small island less than a mile away from Mae-ha-ni. This has been the arrangement since August 1951, when U.S. troops retook the area from North Korea during the Korean War. The American Army set up the practice bombing range unilaterally, without consulting with the South Korean government. Choi Soon-sup is the oldest resident of Mae-ha-ni. He is 87 years old.
I used to have a farm. I planted lettuce, and one day the U.S. Army was driving on my farm, and I got upset. And I hit the soldier in the head with my rake. The soldier pointed a gun at me. Anyway, I don't have a farm anymore. It was about 6,000 square meters, but the government took it away from me.
Choi wasn't the only farmer who lost his land to the bombing range. 67-year-old Che Chu Pin remembers when the U.S. Army seized his family farm in 1951. A year later, an American practice bomb maimed his sister.
In 1952,
when my younger sister was 10 years old, she was looking for oysters on the beach. There was an island called Kuni Island then, but it's all gone now because it's been bombed so much by the Americans. She was working when the American airplane dropped a bomb right next to her. It ripped through her leg and her thigh was destroyed. Since then, she's been lame. One leg is longer than the other.
Che Chu Pin also blames the American Army for his son's disability. He says his son was playing with a slingshot around toxic residue from the bombing when some of the residue got in his eyes. His son has been blind ever since. Two-thirds of Mehanese residents have fled the village since the bombing range opened. Only 2,500 people live in Mehani today. 40 villagers have committed suicide. An Chi-won is South Korea's most famous political pop musician. He grew up in Mehani.
Behind this house was one guard of the shooting range when I was a child. I thought he was dangerous. He was drunk all the time. But now I know that his first wife was killed by a misfired bomb when she was pregnant, so I understand.
Mehanni has become the most controversial military base in South Korea, but it's just one of the many pieces of land America seized without compensation during the Korean War. An hour south of Seoul, the U.S. Army seized hundreds of family farms to build a base called Camp Humphreys. Today, most of the farmers evicted by the U.S. military live in a small town near Camp Humphreys called Keju Village. Over the years, they have rebuilt their lives and started new farms. But it's difficult with Camp Humphreys next door. The irrigation canals that water the farm are filled with untreated oil runoff from the U.S. base. Rice farmer Chong Tae-hwa.
When the water comes from the U.S. base, the river turns black. And when it doesn't rain much, the water is really, really black. This is the water that we use for farming. Before, we could fish from the ocean, but now we can't because the fish all smell like oil and they're black. It was very delicious before when I caught the fish and ate them.
Under the Status of Forces Agreement that governs the American Army in South Korea, the U.S. military is exempt from most environmental laws. Rice farmer Chung Tae-hwa says most of the time the farmers have to clean up after the army.
When the oil is released into the stream, we take the oil out of the stream. We put on rubber clothes and we float paper on the stream. Because of the polluted water, when we go into the water, we get hurt. Our legs look red. They look like mosquito bites. Then we burn the paper in a big fire, and the smoke goes up into the air.
Today, the U.S. military maintains 96 bases in South Korea, a number the Pentagon would like to cut in half. But the Pentagon's plans won't mean fewer U.S. troops in South Korea. American soldiers are simply being called in from all over the country to a new military base at Camp Humphreys that will be more than half the size of San Francisco. And that means elderly farmers like Peng Won Cho will have to move again.
During the Korean War, our land was stolen by the U.S. Army. They drove a bulldozer to kick us out. There was nothing we could do. I had a barn for my cow. They pushed the barn with their bulldozer so the cow ran away. We had a terrible situation. We had experienced terrible things, and again, they want to kick us out. Now they said they would provide us with some money, but we don't want it. Where should we move? Why should we move?
Peng Won Cho says he will lie down in the middle of the road before he loses his land again, and most of his fellow villagers agree. They say they won't sell their land to the Korean government, which seeks to buy their land with Korean tax dollars before turning it over to the Pentagon for free.
We'll have more about the Korean War 50 years after with correspondents Aaron Glantz and Nak Wen in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a CD or a cassette copy, call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. 529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org.
U.S. military involvement in South Korea began even before the Korean War. After World War II, Japanese colonial rule came to an end, and the U.S. stepped in. After 3 years of direct military rule, America installed Syngman Rhee as president of South Korea in August of 1948. That same year, residents of Jeju, an island off the southern coast of Korea, defied the military dictatorship, instead choosing self-rule. Rhee ordered his troops to crush the rebellion. U.S. trained and funded paramilitary units killed between 30 to 60,000 people and forced another 40,000 to flee to Japan. But details of the assault are still largely unknown. George Katsiafikas of the Peace Island Foundation.
For so many years, it was impossible to speak about this horrendous massacre. It's like one quarter of the island's population and involved so many rapes that it's very difficult, I think, for people to fathom it. Recently, with the change from the military government to the democratic government, one would think that, well, now the truth can be told. But people are still so afraid that the South Korean parliament passed a special law promising that if people came forward, they might get compensation and they definitely would not be prosecuted. And still, of course, many people refused to testify.
Up until 1988, Koreans struggled against a succession of military dictatorships. In 1979, General Park Chung-hee, who ruled Korea for 18 years, was assassinated by a rival and chief of the Korean CIA. On May 17, 1980, General Chun Doo-hwan seized control and declared martial law. The next day, protesting students seized the city. The movement quickly spread to the entire population. Lee Jae-woo, who participated in the May uprising, edited a book of eyewitness accounts by journalists.
So many people were killed. That's the reason why people were so angry, and they uprised by themselves, and they armed by themselves, and they wanted to defend this city against the military army.
Chun Yun-hae is currently the vice mayor of Gwangju. During the May uprising, she carried a gun and fought alongside other protesters.
After my husband was arrested on May 17, 1980, I felt compelled to participate in the uprising. I took part in numerous kinds of activities. I alerted activists to dangerous situations and encouraged them to go into hiding.
Most of the women didn't carry guns. Typically, they cooked food for the men, cared for the wounded, organized blood drives and helped assemble large rallies to keep morale up. The protesters won the first round. They kicked out the paratroopers and ran the city themselves. Within a week, though, tanks rolled into Gwangju. More than 1,000 were injured and even more were arrested. 200 were killed. Nao San fought in the Gwangju uprising. He walks through the cemetery, reliving the experience again.
Yun San Wan, at the time of the Gwangju uprising, he was the spokesperson of a student group. His dead body couldn't be identified because his body was torn apart by gunfire. In his pocket, there were name cards of foreign journalists, so that was how he could be identified, because he was the spokesperson. Through the 1970s and 1980s, he was very radical and actively involved in the Korean democratic movement.
Today, as Nao San points out the graves of his dead comrades, he says he feels guilty to be alive.
Those stones don't have names of the victims, because at that time, the people didn't have a chance to identify the dead. The gravestones for all of them read, "Unknown Fighter." There are about 60 people officially listed as missing.
During the 1980 uprising, student protesters carried signs saying, "America, our savior," hoping the United States would enter the conflict on their side and help overthrow the military dictatorship. Instead, a special task force in Washington, headed by then-President Jimmy Carter, gave South Korea's generals the go-ahead. For many South Koreans, the Gwangju uprising was the first time they saw the hand of America in their oppression.
The Gwangju Uprising lay the foundation for another pro-democracy movement in Korea. Every year on May 18th, students around the country turned out for memorial commemorations, even though such events were banned by the government. Then, in 1987, tens of thousands of students in every city across the nation took to the streets to demand reforms, among them popular elections and freedom of the press. The protesters were victorious. The general in power agreed to the reforms. In 1993, Kim Il-sung was elected, and in 1995, he put South Korea's former dictators on trial for murder in connection with the Gwangju massacre.
Heroine Jeong Doan. Heroine Mo Tae-woo.
The two generals were sentenced to death and 22 years in prison, though both officials were pardoned shortly thereafter. In 1997, the country's leading dissident politician, Kim Dae-jung, was elected president. He implemented a sunshine policy that opened the door to free speech and more engagement with North Korea. But significant curbs on civic life remain. The National Security Law was implemented in 1948, only a few months after the U.S. appointed a general president of South Korea. Implemented in the heat of the Cold War, the law prohibited any Korean from saying or doing anything that could have been interpreted as supporting the Communist North. For decades, the law has been used to imprison activists working toward reunification or peace. The national security law is weaker today, but it is still working to restrict dissidents. Hundreds of students and parents protested in front of the South Korean Justice Department, demanding amnesty for more than 150 student activists wanted for violating the country's national security law. The government outlawed the country's largest student group, Hanchunryong, in 1997. Among the group's goals are promoting unification and independence and democracy. But the government declared the students' activities were helping the enemy, North Korea, and so many of the students were thrown in prison. To avoid getting arrested, some students have chosen to go into hiding for as long as 7 years. Chun Chae-wook is the current president of Hanchunryong. He's been hiding at Junsei University in Seoul for 2 years. There are 80 officers working full-time looking for Chun Chae-wook. The officer who catches him will receive a promotion and a cash reward.
If I have a schedule outside the school, I need to have a spy operation. Then I need to find out if there are any policemen hiding themselves outside the school. If I'm sure it is clear, then I can go out.
Among the hardships hiding students endure is not being able to see family members. At a demonstration in front of the Justice Ministry, Kim Nak-hee imagines what life is like for her son, Lee San-la, who is hiding.
He may have to sleep on the frozen ground, and if there is no food and no one gives him food, he may be starving. And even though he may want to, he can't see his family. He can't freely make a telephone call because the police can trace it. It's not only his problem, but all the students' problem.
Kim Seong-kyo is attorney with Minbyun, or Lawyers for a Democratic Society. He provides counsel to some students who have warrants issued by the government for their arrest. He says the national security law conflicts with the country's growing engagement with the North.
The national security law only examines activities that benefit North Korea or not. But what if it benefits South Korea too? For example, the movement to change the armistice to a peace treaty. That benefits North Korea, but it also benefits South Korea. There's also the issue of withdrawing troops from South Korea. That should be allowed in this democratic society. But under the national security law, that's considered benefiting North Korea. So the real problem is, what's the standard for deciding what violates the rule?
Since the return of democracy to Korea in the 1990s, the national security law has mostly been used to clamp down on students protesting the U.S. troop presence in Korea. At a courthouse an hour and a half north of Seoul, 9 students are handcuffed and taken away in a police van. 4 days before, 12 students broke into a U.S. military base and climbed on a tank during exercises where it fired live ammunition in the direction of North Korea. Once on top of the tank, the students burned the American flag. Burning the South Korean flag is legal here, but under the national security law, burning the American flag is against the law. While the 9 students are behind bars, hundreds more rally outside the U.S. Embassy in downtown Seoul. A 3-foot-tall wooden tank is brought in front of the crowd. It's not only about one military exercise, an activist tells the crowd. It's about the continuous presence of the U.S. military, which he says is a threat to peace and a barrier to reunification between North and South Korea. The students move forward and stomp on the wooden tank, crushing it. A song blares through the loudspeakers. You Yankees should listen to the outraged voice of the Korean people. Listen to the people's desire for reunification and liberation. In the meantime, Koreans are doing what they can to increase communication between North and South on their own. On Independence Day, South Korea's state-owned broadcaster KBS broadcast live from Pyongyang in North Korea for the first time. The popular sing-along program staged in a public park was hosted by a South Korean whose entire family lives in the North. Many of the performers cried as they sung of separated families and the beauty of Pyongyang. There was no direct politics in the show, only the idea that the two Koreas should soon become one. We live together, the song goes. Let's live happily for 500 and 1,000 years.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, the Korean War 50 years after, with correspondents Na Gwen and Aaron Glantz. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Donovan Watts, Jade Paget-Seekins, Jesus Solario, John Watanabe, Josette King, Josh Shokrian, Kevin Say, Lindsay Goldsmith, Rudy Tabasa, and Tien N. Vo for production assistance. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. If you'd like a CD or cassette copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law founding director, production manager Philip Babbage, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and I'm your host and associate producer, Amy Pomerleau. Until next time.